It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Olive oil puzzle. With extra virgins going for $3 to $70 a quart, how do you know what the oil tastes like before you plunk down your money? Well, our guest is Deborah Krasner, author of The Flavors of Olive Oil, a tasting guide and cookbook. She's taste-tested 150 different oils. The Stearns discover a species of sausage known only in Washington, D.C. He of the golden palate, David Rosengarten, talks Spanish hams, the new ones coming into the country. We hear the results of the Cook's Illustrated salt tasting and learn why Nouveau Beaujolais is unlike any other wine. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Per me e per te. Amore, 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 perdi fiato. Quante volte di notte t'ho sognato e t'ho cercato dal mare fino al monte, come assetato cerca la sua fonte. Seccato.
Come un miraggio, amore che viene e che va.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's something of a tasting show. We have an olive oil shopper's crib sheet. What to check out on that bottle of extra virgin before you buy. Our guest is Deborah Krasner, author of The Flavors of Olive Oils, a tasting guide and cookbook. Another professional taster and explorer, David Rosengarten, reports on the new Spanish hams coming into the country. Cook's Illustrated magazine editor Chris Kimball tells us about their salt tasting and how it turned out. Winemaker Nan Bailey reveals the odd process that makes Nouveau Beaujolais. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with those two traveling tasters, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, one of the very few specialties unique to the capital of the United States, Washington, D.C., is the half smoke.
What's a half smoke?
Well,
sounds like a little cigar, Michael.
It is. It looks like a little cigar, I guess. No, what it is, it's a lightly smoked sausage. And you can tell I'm getting sideways into my favorite topic here, which is hot dogs, because in fact, a half smoke resembles a hot dog, but it's thicker. It's a sausage. It's unique to Washington, D.C. It's served in chili parlors, convenience stores, and hot dog stands in and around the Capitol. We've seen it nowhere else.
What does it taste like?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a smoky link, but not too smoky. In other words, the smoke doesn't overwhelm the sausage. It's kind of, I don't know what the exact mixture is. It's pork and beef, and at our favorite place to eat one, Ben's Chili Bowl on U Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. It's cooked on the griddle, so the outside gets very crusty, crackly, so when you bite into it, it snaps. The inside is very, very juicy. And of course, if you want to eat it the correct way, you get it in a bun topped with Ben's chili. Ben's Chili Bowl has specialized in half smokes since it opened in 1958. And it's one of those places that a lot of celebrities, when they come through town, no matter what else they're doing, they stop at Ben's for one, two, or three half smokes with chili on them.
Ben's is located on U Street in Washington, and U Street is called the Black Broadway, because there were legitimate theaters there that specialized in African-American theater and musical acts. And the neighborhood has really gone through its ups and downs, but through all of the ups and downs, Ben has remained one of the fixtures on U Street. And to this day, when Bill Cosby comes to town, he never visits Washington, D.C. without going to U Street and eating at least three half smokes at Ben's.
Well, what is this place like? I mean, is it like a lunch counter?
Yeah, it's a hot dog joint lunch counter. The way it works is you walk in, you step up to the counter, you place your order for either half smokes or hot dogs, which by the way are very wonderful themselves, or perhaps just a bowl of chili. Then you sit down and the food is brought to you. It's a real kind of neighborhood hangout, very friendly place. We have never gone there when there aren't a lot of people kind of hanging out on the sidewalk outside, chit-chatting, carrying on. It's a real sort of crossroads sort of place where a lot of people feel very comfortable. In fact, one of the interests, it's got a fabulous history, which you can, there's a whole page of history you can pick up on their counter. One of the things we learned is that, you know, during the riots of 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. Ben's was about the only business in Washington, D.C. to stay open. It was right across from the office of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and it was a place where the firefighters, the activists, and the people trying to keep peace all gathered together in peace over half smokes.
You know, what occurs to me is Washington is not what I would call a bargain city. Eating there can get really expensive. Do you have any other places like Ben's, you know, where there are some good deals to be had?
Yeah, there's one other one I would highly recommend in terms of bargains, and that is the Florida Avenue Grill. It's primarily a breakfast place, although you can have lunch and supper there. We go there for breakfast of bacon, eggs, or better than bacon, actually, country ham, and they make these wonderful stewed apples that are just stewed to the point where they're almost applesauce, but they still have the texture of apples. A real soul food kind of restaurant with biscuits, gravy, and it's a lunch counter kind of place where I don't think it's possible, even if you get the country ham, to spend more than $5 or $6 on a meal.
And they have the best grits, and they also have freshly made red-eye gravy for the country ham, which is just divine.
I like this. Okay, we have another Stern's low-fat diner collection.
Another health food selection.
I like this. Hey, thanks, guys.
Okay, Lynn, take care.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gene and Michael Stern have a new updated edition of their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look around. There's a lot of information, recipes, wine info, resources. Click on the Splendid Table forum to talk food with other listeners and take a look at the store. It's some of the foods I love, and the proceeds support the show. Right now, there's a Tomato Lovers Pasta Dinner gift box. Believe it or not, there is a jarred tomato sauce worth getting excited over. Check it out on the site, splendidtable.org. You may know David Rosengarten from his Food Network shows, his cookbooks, or his wine expertise. Well, David now has a newsletter, The Rosengarten Report. He focuses on individual foods with comparative tastings and research. He's always hunting down the exceptional, and he shares his finds with us. Hey, David, welcome back.
Hello, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. What have you been discovering lately?
Oh, boy. I've been going ham crazy. Now, Lynn, I'm so respectful of your wonderful Italian knowledge and background and all, but I must tell you that Italian prosciutto, wonderful as it is, even the most glorious prosciutto di Parma or San Daniele, is not as good to me as the most glorious Spanish ham. Did I make a boo-boo?
No, you didn't make a boo-boo because I have to tell you, honestly, I know squat about Spanish ham. So I'm open. I'm dubious, but I'm open.
Right.
But tell me, is this the famous Serrano ham that you're talking about?
Yes. And of course, you know, many of your listeners probably have not had a chance to even taste this thing because for many years it has not been allowed into the U.S., just like for many years prosciutto was not allowed into the U.S.
Right.
But prosciutto came back, as you know, 10 or 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the Spaniards are still struggling to get their ham in here. Now, when you go to Spain, you will find Spain is a ham-obsessed country, and you will find hams all over the place. And the general name for it is jamón serrano, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And this ham is made from a pig that has a white coat. But there is a very special pig that is indigenous to the south and the southwest of Spain. It's a pig with a black coat, and it also has a black nail, which is really quite unusual. And in fact, when you go to a tapas bar in Spain and they're cutting you ham from this particular pig, they hang the leg on the wall so that you can see the black nail. And in fact, some unscrupulous restaurant owners have been painting nails black to try to fake it. But you have to find this black pig. Now, this black pig, when it is raised in the wild and when it feeds on the wild acorns, then it gets the full name that is granted by the Spanish government. Let me say it for you, because this is a name to remember. It's called Jamón Ibérico de Balata. And that means that you have a black-nailed pig that's been raised in the wild eating wild acorns. And the ham from that pig, though it costs $100 a pound in Spain, is
$100 a pound.
When the exchange rate is good.
Oh, my God.
goodness.
I mean, it's insane, this ham. Now, here's the difference to me. As you well know, the glory of prosciutto is its kind of velvety, silky quality and its subtlety. The jamón ibérico de bellota is not like that at all. It's chewier. It's a little tougher than prosciutto.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a different color. It's got a darker, more purpley color. The fat is a little less white, a little more yellow. And the taste is unbelievably deep, sweet, funky, nutty. Lynn, stop me.
So at $100 a pound, can I get this in the States? Is it available?
Well, this very finest stuff is not quite available yet, but let me tell you what is available. Two real Spanish hams have come into the U.S. in the last year, and this is the type of ham that's known as Serrano. This is not the black-coated, not the black nail pig, but it's still fabulous ham. There are two brands in the U.S. now. One is called Navidul, and one is called Redondo Iglesias. And of the two, I prefer the Redondo Iglesias, which you can get, there's a sealed package of it, half pound of slices for $10.75. Or you can buy a whole ham for $225. But these are excellent hams, both of them. However, the real excitement is that there is an online company called Tienda, and they're tienda.com. And listen to this. They are now taking orders from people. If you want to order one of these great hams, the jamón ibérico de bellota.
Right.
And in fact, it comes from this town called Jabugo, which to ham freaks, you know, makes their hearts stop.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to order one of these Jabugo hams for Christmas 2004, you contact these people right now. They will put your order in and they will start curing your ham in time for Christmas 2004. And I suspect that they are betting that by then they're going to have the legal stuff worked out and it will be able to come in.
I love this.
It's only $500 for the whole ham.
Oh, well, that's a bargain considering that if I buy it by the pound, it's $100 a pound.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if I have $500 hanging out and I discover I have the patience, I'm going for this one. David, thank
sure.
you.
My pleasure.
Food Authority David Rosengarten is the author of The Rosengarten Report. You can find information on Spanish hams on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I've got no doubt those Spanish hams are very good, but I have to defend my Parma ham. I really can't help myself with this. When this ham is exceptional, it can bring tears to your eyes. Like most great hams, it's made just with salt, air, and thyme. That's it. No chemicals. Now, you're always pushing the envelope with these hams. You have to start with a well-marbled meat that's in prime condition. In fact, this is interesting. If one leg of the pig is bruised, the other leg is never going to cure properly. But the trickiest part is using just enough salt to stop spoilage, but not so much that you lose that porky, delicious, meaty flavor. Then there's the miracle. The fresh meat starts out pink. Salting makes it gray and tough, but in its last months of curing, enzymes go to work. And by 10 or 12 months of age, that Parma ham, and any other ham made this way, turns back to its pink color and becomes tender. So, when a ham's this good, let me make one plea. No fruit, no doodads. You eat a couple of slices of heaven on a plate. Coming up, how to check out olive oils before you buy. Cook's Illustrated Magazine compares salts and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, Super Target features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the Super Target nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Right now, all over the Mediterranean, a race is on. It's the olive harvest. If farmers are making extra virgin olive oil, once those olives are off the tree, they have to be pressed in less than 24 hours. Yet, once those oils are in our markets, the puzzle begins. A quart of extra virgin goes from $3 to $70 in price. And just because it's extra virgin doesn't mean it tastes good. So how do you know what to buy? Well, there is this new book that answers that question. It's called Flavors of Olive Oil, A Tasting Guide and Cookbook. It's by one of our commentators, Deborah Krasner. Now, Deborah has researched olive oil from the ground up. But even more important, she reports on the taste and the use of 150 different oils. Deborah, welcome.
Hi.
So, Deborah, you know, the toughest thing for a lot of us when we're buying olive oil is to figure out what it's going to taste like, because extra virgin isn't the whole deal. Is there anything about the bottle, anything that we can see that gives us...
I mean, the first thing is to look really closely at the whole package, because there are lots of indicators that begin to tell you that a producer is concerned with conserving his oil at its best. So the first thing that you want to look for is a protective dark bottle or a foil wrapping or a box or something that's keeping that olive oil as safe from light as it can be. That's not to say that you can't buy great olive oil in a clear glass bottle. Mm-hmm. You can, but it's more fragile.
So what actually happens when it's exposed to light?
When olive oil is exposed to light, it immediately starts deteriorating. I'll tell you a story. We had a book party for my new book last week in New York, and the olive oils came 4 days before the party. And the party was at a beautiful showroom of the Hayfola company that makes hardware for kitchens. And the person who ran the showroom put the bottles out of their box and put them in a cupboard for safekeeping because she didn't want anyone to steal them. And when we arrived for the party Tuesday, we took the bottles out, and they happened to be in a cupboard that had lattice doors so light could penetrate the interior of the cupboard. It was an upper cupboard, so it was higher in temperature than a lower cupboard, and it was right under banks of halogen lights. By Tuesday at 5 o'clock, those oils were half dead. They had lost at least 50% of their flavor. And the whole party was about an olive oil tasting, which made it embarrassing. But it was such an illustration of how rapidly great oils can deteriorate under bad conditions.
Can you look at the color of the oil and know anything about it?
No, color is deceptive. I mean, consumers think that the greener an oil, the better it is. But in fact, color can be manipulated either through the color of the glass or by putting leaves through the press with the olives. And color is not necessarily an indicator of anything.
Mm-hmm. What about the label? What should we look for on the label?
You want as much transparency from producer to consumer as you can get. So the ideal label says, produced by this man in this place under these conditions, the olives were handpicked, they were pressed using the Sonolia method. In other words, you want to know as much as possible so that if necessary, you can trace back that oil to exactly the place that it came from.
What about dates? How reliable
dates,
are they?
Well, I have never heard of a date fraud, if that's what you're asking. Uh-huh. You want to know when the oil was harvested, because unlike wine, oil deteriorates as it ages. It doesn't increase in its potency. And so you always want to be cooking with the most recent harvest. And in the Mediterranean, that harvest is in November, and then the oil is racked for a couple of months. So it doesn't reach the United States usually until January, February, March, April, somewhere in winter, late winter, early spring. And so every label should either have a consume-by date, which will be 2 years beyond that harvest. Mm-hmm. So if it's the 02 harvest, then it'll say consume-by 04,
right.
Or else it'll have the actual date of the harvest.
Well, Deb, you talk about oil not being exposed to light. Now, does that mean we should be buying oil in metal cans? I mean, don't they get a metallic taste?
No, I've never experienced a metallic taste from a metal can. I have to say that if you have a choice between a clear glass bottle or a tin, always go for the tin, because the tin is going to have preserved the oil better. However, even better than a tin, I think, are ceramic containers, which, of course, were the original amphora that were used for olive oil. And somehow, we've been finding in our tastings that olive oil that's in a ceramic container often has the best flavor.
Hmm. How do you know when an olive oil is over the hill?
Oh, you know it. If you've had any experience tasting oils, you will know in that first sniff, before you even put it in your mouth, that something isn't right. There are a couple of really telltale aromas when you open a can or a bottle for the first time before you even taste it. If you smell bananas, you know that oil, it's not rancid, it's just not good anymore. Similarly, if you get a cucumber smell, that only happens in tins. That means that it's been in the tin for 2 or 3 years. But real rancid oil, it smells musty. You're going to instinctively wrinkle your nose. It's going to look brownish and kind of viscous in an unpleasant way. Rancid oil is really apparent.
Well, now, if you have to keep it away from light and away from heat, do you ever keep olive oil in the refrigerator?
Well, you know, there are mixed messages on this. Truthfully, I do. But I only keep the oil in the refrigerator that I'm conserving. The oil that I'm using every day stays in a dark cupboard. But if you're like me and you have a lot of oils in the house and there are some that you know you're not going to be using for a while, then I think it's okay to keep them in the refrigerator. The difficulty with refrigerating oil is if you use it all the time, two different things happen. The first is you have to bring it to room temperature and get it liquid again before you use it. And so then you put it under hot running water and you kill the oil. Or if you open and close the refrigerator a lot, you can have condensation within the bottle. And that, of course, means that there's water mixing with the oil.
Uh-huh.
However, I think for deep storage, I don't have any problem with putting it in the refrigerator.
Well, now I want to challenge you. This is my all-time favorite question for our guests. Three oils you would love us to try.
Well, first of all, I want you to try Cola Vita, because Cola Vita is the most interesting of the supermarket, mass market supermarket oils. It's really kind of an amazing olive oil. It's from Tuscany, and it has terrific flavor for the price. So that's one.
Okay, and now we can get anywhere. Okay. Two?
Yes, okay. Two is an oil from Sicily, which is one of my favorites. It's called Olio Verdi, and it comes in a beautiful bottle, and it's harder to find, although it's in gourmet stores. Dina De Luca carries it, among other places, and it's a really lusty, olivey and peppery oil. And the third is a great olive oil from Spain. It's one of the greatest of all the olive oils produced in Spain. And you probably know that Spain is the world's largest olive oil producer. And that is called Baena Nunez de Prada. And that is just a wonderful, unfiltered olive oil. And its method is called the flowering of the oil, which means that the olives are just lightly crushed and the oil that rises to the top, just like fleur de sel, is what's produced as Baena Nunez de Prada. It's just an extraordinary olive oil. I love it.
Oh, Deb, thank you.
Thank you.
Deborah Krasner is author of The Flavors of Olive Oil, a tasting guide and cookbook. She left us with what she calls a 12-minute dinner. It's flash-roasted salmon and oven-roasted asparagus. Get the recipes on the website, splendidtable.org. And one last word on olive oil. This is my pet peeve. When stores put out olive oils to taste with bread, ask for a spoon. That bread masks the flavors. It's there to sell the oil. Salt is the latest craze among chefs and foodies. Lord knows we've spent enough time talking about it here on The Splendid Table. Now, you could spend up to $40 a pound on the stuff. And we're hearing about all kinds of salts. Red salt, gray salt, salt from different seas, salt that's kosher. And, of course, everybody now is turning up their noses on plain old table salt. Well, it's time for serious evaluation, and that means turning to Cook's Illustrated magazine, The Consumer Reports for the Gourmet Crowd. Publisher and editor Christopher Kimball joins us. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, Chris, you did a salt tasting at Cook's. Now, do you think this fuss over salt is just over the top?
Oh, well, clearly the marketing folks have gotten hold of this. You see it all over newspapers now and magazines about how you get the Hawaiian salt or Indian salt and the different colors and flavors. Well, we set out recently to find out if that's true. As you said, some salt's almost $40 a pound. Morton's is 36 cents a pound. So there actually is a reason you'd want to know the answer to the question, does it matter? We dissolved it in spring water and chicken stock and pasta cooking water. We baked salt in biscuits, and we actually sprinkled some salt onto pieces of roasted beef tenderloin. And the results were fascinating.
Well, now, which salts were you tasting?
We had nine salts, the cheapest being the Morton's, iodized and non-iodized, and the most expensive would be the Fleur de Sel, flour of salt, $36 a pound. And other ones were also, you know, $13 to $20, like Malden, for example, or Esprit de Sel.
Mm-hmm. Now, who was the big winner?
Well, what we found is when you dissolved salt in water or any kind of liquid,
right,
you can't tell the difference.
Really?
It just doesn't matter. Yeah. Now, what we did is we sent the salts out to a laboratory, had them measure some mineral contents of magnesium, for example. And it's true that sea salts will have a higher magnesium count than, let's say, Morton's, which has none.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of magnesium would be, you know, 10 or 20 milligrams. The recommended daily allowance of magnesium is 400 milligrams. So you're not dealing with very much. By weight, the minerals are less than 1% of the salt. So it just doesn't matter at all. The only thing that does matter is the shape of the crystal. And it turns out that the bigger the crystal, and it's sort of oddly shaped, when you actually taste it, let's say, sprinkled on food,
right,
you have a different sensory experience. So it's not so much the mineral content. It's just it's different in your mouth. So we would recommend sprinkling on beef, for example, or on something else where you're going to actually taste the salt as it is. Sure, get big crystals. Malden sea salt actually was the one we liked best when sprinkled on the meat. But, you know, you're not going to be too far off getting kosher salt, which also has large crystals. The kosher salt is about 50 cents a pound. The Malden was about $13 a pound. So, you know, where's the beef here? It doesn't seem to us that it makes a big difference.
So how did table salt do sprinkled on meat?
We did not like, actually, the table salt, the Morton's, sprinkled on meat. We found it harsh and sharp. Those are the adjectives used by our tasters.
Mm-hmm.
They found it was sort of bitter and concentrated. Now, in baking, however, we found that the bigger crystals were not successful. We found the finer grade of salt, table salt, worked better in baking because it distributes itself more evenly throughout the baked product.
So something like this famous Fleur de Sel, which is that first concentration of salt that when the water starts to evaporate, the sea salt, that didn't stand out in any way? Because we've heard it's scented with violets or it smells like lobster. And that didn't stand out when sprinkled on meat?
Well, we thought it had, quote unquote, great crunch. I don't know about the lobster part, but we found that, yeah, it was good on the tenderloin. It came in second after Malden. By the way, Fleur de Sel is the most expensive salt. It's $36 a pound. But, you know, it really comes down to the fact that when you're eating salt on meat or anything else, there's a lot of things going on in your mouth, and a small amount of mineral content just isn't going to be noticeable when taken with other things that you're eating. So, yeah, if you're just going to eat salt on your own with nothing else, maybe. But when you pair it with food, you're just going to lose all those subtleties.
So
look, if it makes you feel good, I mean, go out and buy it by all means. It makes you feel like a gourmet cook. But, you know, 99% of the time, nobody's going to know the difference.
Chris, you've saved us some money. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. My pleasure.
Christopher Kimball is publisher and editor of Cook's Illustrated Magazine. The results of their salt tasting ran in the September-October 2002 issue. We now know more about what our food does to our bodies than at any other time in history. Seems like a good idea, but is it?
So So when did macaroni and cheese become death on a plate? It's macaroni and cheese, for God's sake. Comfort food for America. It's exhausting, this American obsession with all that's wrong with food. There used to be things you plain knew were bad for you. Ho-hos, martinis, Slim Jims. But now, they say grilling a steak can give you cancer. And that's not including all the bad things we already knew about steak, like arteries clogged as bad as a straw in a thick milkshake. They say there's some new carcinogen that comes from burning oil or something. It's in French fries, too. And don't even start to read the labels. What are those ingredients? Thiamine, mononitrate, guar gum. What is guar? Does it grow on trees? Does it give you cancer? I want to know, but I don't want to know, you know? I want to eat a hot dog at the ballpark, like I did when I was a kid, trusting of hot dogs and their salty plumpness on a summer night. Now we worry. We worry about dioxin in the fish, hormones in the chicken, antibiotics in the meatballs. Where does it end? Did you notice the French fries give you cancer story was buried in the back pages of the newspaper? Nobody wants to hear that, not even newspaper editors, who are probably eating French fries at their desks on deadline. I grew up in a world where macaroni and cheese was good for you. It was a land where Pop-Tarts made a fine breakfast, where salami came to lunch, where cafeteria ladies shoveled fish sticks onto wet plastic trays. I bet there's even something wrong with fish sticks now. The only scary thing about food back then was when the grown-ups tossed flailing lobsters into a boiling pot and then sucked the spiny claws, or when they ate oysters that were still alive. The rest of it was just food, plain old food. It was good for you. Now we check labels, count fat grams, order a salad for lunch. Last week, I didn't. Last week, I went to a cafeteria at the mall. They didn't have fish sticks, but they had macaroni and cheese, the baked kind with the brown crust on top. The cafeteria lady served me a big plate. It was the best. I think it was made with Velveeta.
Julie Hausserman is a Capitol reporter in Tallahassee, Florida, for the St. Petersburg Times. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What's the difference between regular soy sauce and tamari soy sauce? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a full-service grocery store, and Target, together in one stop. Super Target has a variety of ingredients and imported spices for those holiday recipes you want to try. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what's the difference between regular soy sauce and tamari soy sauce? Well, it's wheat. A true tamari has none, and other soy sauces do. Now, when Chinese soy sauces are about 2 years old, they're labeled black soy, dark soy, or, and this gets a little confusing, soy, comma, superior. And they're used in hearty dishes. Younger or light soy sauce is labeled superior soy or just soy sauce, and it's used in more subtle dishes. Now, I said true tamari soy sauce is done without wheat, but check labels, because often that term tamari is just a marketing ploy. But the real point I want to make is that soy sauces aren't all alike. So if you have an Asian market in your town, splurge a little. Live it up. Try some different imported soy sauces. They're as varied as wines. Opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Jimmy on the line. So, Jimmy, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Len. I've been having trouble figuring out a good way to braise bok choy.
Braise bok choy. Now, have you got the big bok choy or the big bok choy?
Big bok choy.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the great ways of doing it. Do you want to do it Chinese style?
I want to do it delicious style.
forget the origin. You just want delicious.
Right.
I hear you. Because one of the things that's done in Chinese cooking is that it's sort of a classic way of handling it. You take a very hot skillet or a big wok. You put it over high heat. When it's very hot, you film it with a little bit of oil. You drop into it minced garlic and ginger. Just stir it around for a second or two. Okay. And then you have the chopped up bok choy. Keep the leaves chopped, but on the side for a moment. And you throw that in and you stir fry it, sprinkling it with salt and pepper. This is very simple, but very pure. It's beautiful. And after you've stir fried it for a minute or two, you throw in the chopped leaves and then you sprinkle it with a few tablespoons of either dry white wine or Chinese rice wine. And if you want, you can add a little bit of oyster sauce to that, you know, like a tablespoon or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you stir fry that. And some people like to eat it hot. We love it at room temperature.
Okay.
Because it's just a lovely thing. Now, another thing that you can do is that you can take that bok choy, stir fry it, add broth and wine, and cover it or just let it simmer in that and make a broth where you serve it in that mixture and you add a little hot chili garlic oil to it just before it goes to the table.
That's kind of the way I've been doing it. I've been simmering it in a combination of chicken stock and a little bit of white wine.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that sounds
I've been
great.
adding a little of that sambal oleic.
Oh, yes, that hot chili paste from Indonesia.
Right, yeah. But I was having trouble with when you put the leafy part in and, you know, when you use the crunchy part.
Okay, the crunchy part, you put the crunchy part in first.
Mm-hmm.
And if the leaves are pretty tender, one of the things people do is they cut them up into small pieces, however you want to do that, and they go in at the very end.
Okay.
So you get a little bit of the fresh leaf, and then you get the tender stalk.
Mm-hmm.
And you really can decide about the stalk. You either want it well done, which means almost melting.
Right.
Or you want to cook it very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way. Now, there is a third way, which is done in China, where it is stir-fried with ground pork, and you have mixed the ground pork with chopped water chestnuts and soy sauce and garlic and you know, what seems like a little hoisin sauce. And you do the garlic ginger thing with the oil.
Mm-hmm.
You drop in that pork and you stir fry it for a few moments, very high heat on this. And then you drop in the bok choy that's been cut up. And the greens go in again at the last. And you stir fry that until the pork is done and the bok choy is done. And oh, that's sensational. And that gets tossed with noodles.
Oh, sounds like a wonderful main course.
It's a beautiful main course. It's a gorgeous main course. And you can throw other things in there like a lot of ginger or a lot of garlic.
Sounds great.
So we've got three choices here.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your help.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Good.
Okay.
Bye.
People don't think a lot about what to do with bok choy. And it's out there. It's in all the markets. You know, you're seeing it now. You don't have to go to an ethnic market to get it. And it's one of those nice neutrals it takes to a lot of different things. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Well, It turns out I misspoke recently in a trivia question, and you folks let me know about it, and I appreciate it. I was talking about avocados, and I said that that word was Spanish for lawyer, but that really it became the name of the fruit because it is derived from an Aztec word. I had checked two sources on this information, but what I've learned from all of you is avocado is not the Spanish word for lawyer. The Spanish word for lawyer is abogado. Thanks, guys, and sorry for the error. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's up? We've got Gail on the line. Hey, Gail, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have five young geese that I would like to try to do something with the holidays.
Are they in the house?
We live on a farm.
They are outside. I see. Okay.
And anyway, I've had geese before, eaten them, that is.
Yeah.
And I haven't really cared for kind of a greasy, oily taste that I've all too often encountered with them.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, Lynn, if you had any suggestions, and I'm wondering specifically, are geese something that you should look at trying to stuff or prepare dressing? Do I cook them hot and fast or low and slow? What kind of pan should I use? And another crazy question, is a turkey fryer, can you deep fat fry these?
I think it's a very good question. I think it's a crazy question. I mean, when you think about all that... I just had a scathingly brilliant idea.
Okay.
Now, I'm going back to a long, long time ago when I used to be very much involved in Chinese cooking. There is, if I recall correctly, a method in Chinese cooking where you take a duck, which is also very fatty, you do a lot of pinpricks, and you steam the duck. So it gets, and you keep making little pin pricks in the, you know, fork pricks in the
right.
skin. So the fat keeps draining off.
Okay.
But you steam this duck until it is essentially cooked. It's very moist. It's very juicy. And you've gotten rid of a good deal of the fat.
Okay.
And then you deep fry this baby.
Okay.
And the skin gets crisp, and you think you have just, you know, you have had a surreal experience.
Okay.
Well, why wouldn't that work for goose?
And I do have a couple here to kind of experiment around with.
Well, it sounds like when you've got five of them, there are not many people I know who have five lined up, ready to roll. Well, you know, I think this is really worth a try. Now, let's make up a recipe.
Great.
You want to do Asian style?
That I'm open to anything. That sounds really good.
Okay. This is what I would do. I would take the goose. I would rub it inside and out with Chinese five spice powder. And
okay.
If you can't get that, as I recall, I think it's nutmeg, star anise, and you could use regular anise instead, and cinnamon and black pepper and clove, I think.
Okay.
But the idea is rub that all over the duck, maybe even rub it with a lot of garlic and a bit of soy sauce. Put it in the fridge overnight. Don't wrap it tight. Just let it sit. And then you arrange a steamer. So it has to be suspended over simmering water.
Okay.
It can be in a plate, or it could even just be on a steamer rack.
Sure.
With a lid so that there's steam circulating around it. And you're going to have to steam that probably 10 minutes to the pound, maybe a little bit more. And every once in a while, you open up the steamer. Be careful not to get burned. And you prick it. You just prick it to help it give up all of its fat. And I'd turn it over midway. So figure more or less 10 minutes to the pound. Test the thigh muscle to see it's about 170 degrees. That'll tell you it's done. Then you can set it aside. You can chill it even. But when you want to cook, when you want to finish it off, put it in that deep fryer, 375 degrees, until it's crisp, which may be 15 or 20 minutes. And that's it.
Okay.
And serve it with a dipping sauce. You know, maybe some soy sauce and hoisin sauce and garlic and hot chili.
Okay.
And see what happens. The other answer to your question is always slow roast the goose on a rack. Believe it or not, it's lean meat under a lot of fat. So 325 degrees, 15 minutes to the pound. And I don't make stuffing inside the goose because it's so greasy.
Would there be any point in my trying one of those vertical cookers?
The vertical roasters are great. The Hispanic vertical roaster is really the gold standard. That brand is about the best. I've been using it for years, and I think it would be worthwhile doing it. Even though it's high temperature cooking, it works like a charm with duck.
Okay.
And everything drains off. Just prick a lot. That's one of the keys. Okay?
Thank you very much.
And go and cook your goose.
Thanks again. Bye.
You're welcome. I've always wanted to say that to someone. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Matt on the line. Matt, what's happening?
How you doing, Lynn?
I'm doing swell.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, I enjoy using my cast iron skillet, and I take a lot of pride in the seasoning I do of the skillet, the preparation both before and after I cook something. But when it comes to eggs, this is obviously, you know, operator error. I cannot figure out how to cook any kind of egg dish or eggs in the skillet without having them stick completely to the bottom to become an absolute mess. Is there, what am I doing wrong?
I have to tell you, you are dealing with one of the trickiest sons of guns that exist in the food world. If an egg can go wrong in a skillet, it's going to. The first thing that comes to mind, they stick, you say.
Yeah.
Now, you know that you never scrub a cast iron skillet, and essentially what you do with it is you build up almost a slick on the bottom. Do you have that on the bottom of yours?
Yeah. In fact, our friends give me a lot of grief because I guard this skillet with my life because it's taken years to get this buildup of shiny.
Yeah.
Basically, it's burnt coagulated oil.
Yes, I know, and I don't want to get into that discussion either because I love it also. All right, two things. First of all, I think this is the reason nonstick skillets took off in sales.
Teflon was invented for this reason.
Yeah, I think so. But the reality is maybe you're using too high heat. You know how it clings to heat. Cast iron holds that heat.
Yeah.
And you want to cook eggs very, very slowly. And the other thing is, if you're cooking them in the cast iron, you want to give them a fair amount of fat to swim around in.
Ah.
You know, that's the bad news for your heart, but it's going to help your eggs. But I think a lot of us tend to try to rush our eggs, and the slower you cook an egg, the more tender it will be and the easier it will be to get out of the pan. And cast iron gets hot. The other thing is, there are those of us who have given up the ghost and turned to a nice Teflon or whatever pan that they only use for eggs. They don't use for anything else.
Yeah, but, that's what I've had to do. But I thought, getting ready to go on a camping trip, and I have to impress everybody in the camp by showing them how I can do eggs in the skillet.
All right. Do you want to know where I keep my Teflon pan? In the back of the closet, and whenever I use it, I shield the view of it with my body.
Uh-huh.
So no one knows I'm using it.
Secret. I like that.
Yeah, now everybody knows. But try low heat and see how that works for you.
Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Matt.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, every November, there's this big fuss over who gets the first bottle of Nouveau Beaujolais. Now, this just translates as new wine. You hear tales of the grapes being pressed right into the bottle and then cases being swept onto planes. But what exactly is Nouveau Beaujolais? We have a winemaker on the line who has lots of firsthand experience making this kind of wine. She is Nan Bailey, winemaker and owner of Alexis Bailey Vineyards in Minnesota. Nan, thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Lynn.
Can you tell me, is this just fresh wine, Nouveau Beaujolais?
It's all about being a fresh wine. In fact, that's why it's called Nouveau, because it's new wine. Most wines that are produced during the harvest, you have to wait one, maybe several years before you can drink them. The wonderful thing about the Nouveau is that it's available to drink right at the end of harvest as kind of a celebration of all the hard work that's put into making the wines.
So is this just wine that's just started to ferment? How is it made?
Well, that's what makes the Nouveau Nouveau. It's the difference in the fermentation that creates the style of wine that enables you to drink it when it's only weeks old. And it's a very unique type of fermentation that's different from how most wines are made, which is a yeast fermentation where you've got yeast and sugar combining to form the alcohol that makes it wine.
Mm-hmm.
With a Nouveau, it's an enzymatic fermentation. And the way that you get this is, and this is what makes it so much fun to make, instead of crushing the grapes, stomping on them, crushing them so you get the fermentation, you take whole berries, put them in a vat, purge the tank of oxygen. It's an anaerobic fermentation. Seal it up. And what happens is, inside the grape, the sugar is converted by virtue of the carbon. That's the catalyst, as opposed to yeast, that converts the sugar to alcohol. So you're literally getting an intracellular fermentation inside the berry.
You mean inside the grape skin?
Inside
it's becoming
the berry,
wine?
Yes. Yeah, it's quite amazing. And I tell you, the most amazing thing is when you uncover the tank after anywhere from 4 to 14 days. That's how long it takes for this process in the tank. When you open the tank up, and I tell you, the first time I made this, I thought, oh my gosh, it didn't work. The grapes look like I just picked them. But when you start to taste the berries,
yeah,
they're no longer sweet. They're a little spritzy on the inside of the berry, and they taste like wine.
It sounds quite miraculous.
Oh, it's delicious.
So how long will this last? You then press that, you put that in the bottle, and that's Nouveau Beaujolais?
The grapes are then crushed and finished with the yeast fermentation. But the carbonic maceration, which is the name of this fermentation, creates a whole different composition in the wine. Less alcohol, less tannin, which gives wine astringency in body. More fruit, less acidity, all the qualities that make the wine drinkable very young. And this wine is all about its fruit. It's not a wine to, like, test your wine knowledge with. It's a wine to just simply enjoy.
Oh, Nan, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Well, winemaker Nan Bailey is owner of Alexis Bailey Vineyards in Hastings, Minnesota. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from the Quran. There is a devil in every berry of the grape. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. You can find everything you heard here this week on our website at splendidtable.org. And while visiting, take a look at the Splendid Table store. We've got it stocked with some of the things I like to keep in my cupboard. And rest assured, all the proceeds go to support the program. So take a look. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.